This Intelligent Medicine podcast is brought to you by Cedarside.com, your all-natural, organic solution to pest control problems, protecting people, pets, and premises. Cedarside.com. Welcome to Intelligent Medicine. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and once again, it's time for Q&A with Layla, which is an opportunity for you to question us about your medical and nutritional problems. For those of you who are new to these podcasts, Layla Mutin is our Hoffman Center nutritionist. We work together on a daily basis, and she is the holder of a master's degree, an advanced master's degree in the field of nutrition, as well as being a registered dietitian. So welcome, Layla.
Hi, Dr. Hoffman. How are you doing?
Very well, thank you. This has been kind of a weird week because we're sort of sandwiched between the Jewish New Year, Rosh Hashanah, and Yom Kippur. And I don't know, it seems a little quiet in the city. I think a lot of people are, kind of off or sort of semi.
Yeah.
It's just a little bit.
We're lamenting the end of summer.
Yeah, maybe that too, yeah. We had some great weather, so we can't complain. The big news, of course, this week, Ebola virus in the U.S.
So scary.
Yeah. This Liberian guy got off the plane and proceeded to have some symptoms that led him to go to an emergency room. They thought he just had a regular respiratory infection. They sent him home with antibiotics. But they didn't think to question him about his travel history, which in retrospect may not have been such a great idea because he traveled from Liberia to London. I think then he hopped on a plane with a bunch of folks. And, I don't even know if that's something that really needs to be looked out for because, you risk exposing an entire plane load of people to the deadly Ebola virus. Although it is said not to be communicable when you're not sick. Bloody vomiting
and really through bodily fluids more than anything, but saliva from a cough or anything can float around the air, and especially a pressurized plane cabin, and that could be problematic, I suppose.
So they say, but then the concern too, and I've enunciated this, is that viruses mutate, and that this is just one step away from becoming a more virulent virus. In other words, more easily transmissible. And it's just so transmissible that a lot of the healthcare workers in Africa don't even know how they got it. I mean, they exercised precautions. Yes, of course, it's very hot. And, they were stifling temperatures. And maybe there was a breach in proper, quarantine and proper gowning and proper handling of body fluids and so on. It's just concerning. So anyway, this is going to be like a fire drill for the American epidemiological response team. Our national health response team.
Response system.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. Hopefully. We do have measures in place, and we do have a very, very sophisticated infrastructure, unlike Africa, where they have virtually nothing. And in fact, not only do they not have a good infrastructure to cope with this, not enough hospital beds, doctors, healthcare workers, and they don't have an organized system to keep track of who's sick and quarantine them and, keep them in out of touch with people who they might reinfect. But they actively drive off and attack healthcare workers because they're in this superstitious mindset. They see that wherever there's a hospital, wherever there's healthcare workers, people are dying. And so in a kind of a primitive association, we say that coincidence is not causation. Two things happening at the same time are not causation. But in a primitive mindset, it's like, hey, these people in the white coats and all of these medical brigades show up and people start dying like flies. So maybe we should drive these people off with pitchforks. And that's what's happening in certain parts of Africa. So it's tragic, and they're going to have some big problems over there. Hopefully we can demonstrate that we can put a cap on this. I was kind of surprised that the first person to come down with this outside of Africa was not a healthcare worker. This happened right here in the good old USA, in the heart of America. I thought it first spread to Asia, you know, populous areas of the Middle East.
Yeah.
But here we are in the good old USA. So, you know, so hopefully, you know,
well,
they're...
The CDC is reassuring us that they have this contained under control, that we should not worry, you know. I think we're hearing a lot about it, too much maybe about it in the media lately, but that's their job.
So this is not the zombie apocalypse?
No.
Not yet?
No.
Okay. All right.
No.
So let's, you know, unfortunately, I think the healthcare system in America has lost a lot of credibility because they've reassured us on so many accounts. I mean, vaccines, I think, is one instance. And, you know, medications, they're perfectly safe, harmless, don't worry about them. The water is safe to drink. The plastic containers are safe to use, and so on and so
especially
on.
Especially in the microwave.
Right. The cosmetics and so on. And then so often that is proven wrong, that a lot of people are deeply suspicious of the healthcare system. But in this case, I think that they are going to be able to do a good job and contain this. And, you know, we hope that also that they'll learn from this. They'll learn better methods of response. And, you know, this is a big training exercise for literally thousands of healthcare workers across the United States,
yeah,
in particular down there in Texas. And also, it's an opportunity to maybe do a little research on what works for sick patients, because we don't have that much of an opportunity to treat patients in the U.S. with all our arsenal of medications and treatments. And in Africa, it's really kind of hard to figure out what works. And here, maybe we'll come up with some answers that'll be good for us, but also will be good in turn for the Africans once we figure out
a better
way to cope with it. So, so let's remain optimistic about that situation. So, we have a bunch of questions. So, let's go to our. By the way,
yes,
let me mention that the way to get us questions: radioprogram@AOL.com. Send us your questions if they're short, to the point, and of general interest. We'll read them on the air. And you'll be able to tune into a podcast and get your question answered. So let's start with our first one.
Okay, we've got Lorraine. Dear Dr. Hoffman, I'm a 62-year-old woman who had a radical hysterectomy at age 40 due to ovarian cancer. I have a small bone frame, fairly severe kyphosis, and the start of osteopenia.
Just let me interrupt for our first listening audience. Kyphosis is when it's a hunchback. It means when you bend forward, and often that is caused by spinal fractures that occur in the vertebral bones, and progressively you bend over more and more and more until this can be impair walking, but it can also impair breathing because you literally shrink the space that your lungs have to expand in. And that's why that's a very devastating condition. But she just has osteopenia.
And that's my question. Do we see severe kyphosis in anyone other than somebody with osteoporosis or advanced osteoporosis?
I think it's a postural thing, you know, to some extent in her case. I don't think she's had vertebral fractures if she just has osteopenia. I think she just may have the kind of reader's posture. I think that all of us who are academically inclined, you know, we tend to sit curled over, you know, peering into books and hunched over our desks and over our computer keyboards. And we get, you know, we get curvature of the spine, so we're not...
Well, I just sat up straighter as you said that. So.
Yeah, everybody's watching their posture as we mentioned that. Okay.
Anyway, Lorraine says, despite all these odds against me, my taking strontium has kept my bone density stable with no change in 5 years.
Great.
I've learned of taking strontium from listening to your radio program and ordering it from your online store. Thank you for your show and your very efficient staff at the online store. Her question is, should I be taking strontium and osteosupport, or is just strontium enough?
Okay. So let me just talk a little bit about when to use strontium. Strontium I like to use for more severe osteopenia, and not just for mild osteopenia, because mild osteopenia is just sort of like the state of normalcy for a lot of women. It's not an immediate call to action to use very powerful medications. I consider strontium sort of an extraordinary powerful supplement that, while I don't really see it as being harmful or dangerous, why use such a powerful supplement if you have mild osteopenia? So I make a call as to whether women really need to use it. I don't think it's something that should be generally used by every woman for prevention of bone loss, although it's being marketed
that way. You don't want to kill a baby ant with a cinder block. That's
exactly. Right.
Yeah.
So the question is, if you really have pronounced osteoporosis, I use a combination of things together, or advanced osteopenia even. And I would consider advanced osteopenia as minus 2.3 or greater, you know, and then it crosses the line at osteoporosis when it gets to minus 2.5 or minus 2.6. That's a T-score of your hip and your spine, and sometimes a little hard to read those and interpret those scores, but you know, it's just as important as your cholesterol number. So learn how to read and understand your T, right, your T score on your DEXA exam. And actually, in a couple of weeks, we're going to do a podcast that I'm very much looking forward to from a woman who is an expert on the DEXA scan. And she has some very interesting things to say about the DEXA scan and its lack of predictive value for bone fractures. That there, you know, some people just... Huh. You pay attention to this like it's the gospel, like, oh my God, you know, I'm going to get a fracture because I have a minus this or minus that. And she has been administering these tests for years and years and years, and she really knows the ins and outs of the testing, and she has concluded that to some extent the tests are not the gospel. They're not completely accurate, that there are other qualities of
there
bone.
There has to be a margin of error, right?
Yeah, there's a margin of error, but also bone may appear dense and not really be strong. You know, we have examples of, so we, you know, like, you know, a... you know, a very gossamer-like bridge structure, you know, it may be very strong, whereas a column made of solid chalk, which is actually the main, you know, calcium carbonate is chalk. That's what makes a bone. But chalk is very brittle, and it while it's dense, it's brittle. So, you know, anyway, she's going to talk about that consideration, so look forward to a podcast. We'll
I actually have a question as you're telling us about this. I have a some DEXA scans include looking at the forearm or wrist.
Right.
What is the purpose of that if that's not really a weight-bearing limb?
Well, it's a
that
it's
would
a,
be an interesting question.
It's a place of major fractures. There's what's called a Colles fracture,
okay,
very common in you know, postmenopausal women. They fall forward, they put their hand out, they break their wrist. However, I got to say that one of the toughest things with conventional medicine or with supplements is to enhance the bone density of the wrist. So we'll sometimes see people where we're really doing a great job with their spine and their hip, but their wrist remains at negative, you know, 3 or 4, which is potentially a danger sign. Most of the drugs and supplements really have an impact on hip and spine and less so on the wrist.
Get on the floor and do push-ups.
Yeah, do weight-bearing exercise.
There's a solution. Absolutely.
Lift some soup cans or light barbells, and that'll actually help strengthen your wrist. Absolutely. So anyway, as to her question, you know, why don't you go through the arsenal of things that we use together with strontium to enhance bone?
With strontium, MK7, which is not a machine gun or a weapon of mass destruction.
Destruction
is vitamin K.
Right.
It's vitamin K. We like Ostera, which is hops, which reduces the bone turnover. We like certainly vitamin D. We would check serum vitamin D levels. We would check magnesium levels as well to make sure that they're where they should be. We also look at DHEA. And I could say almost with certainty, Dr. Hoffman, that when we look at our case studies of reversing osteoporosis, which we have done here at the Hoffman Center, most of them did contain all of these, as well as strontium, as well as some DHEA when we found levels to be too low.
And that's so it's a synergy of things. I think strontium is a really strong player there, but absolutely I would not just simply use strontium. I would certainly use osteosupport, which is a combo of bioavailable calcium, not too much because we don't like to really max out on calcium these days because you don't need as much as we used to think you needed. And it's in bioavailable form, along with some magnesium, along with some boron, along with some lysine, along with some not isoflavone, but actually it does have some isoflavone, and it
genistein.
It has Ipraflavone, which is also a bone-enhancing ingredient. I've been using that formula for like, 15, near 20 years now, and pretty much it stood the test of time and can be very effective. But that, as a standalone, isn't enough to... It may be enough to slow bone loss. And in her case, I might just use, you know, the Ostera and the osteosupport, the vitamin D and the vitamin K, and maybe skip the strontium. That will stabilize the bone, maybe enhance it slightly. And if you really want to put on bone, then you use strontium. That will actually dramatically increase your score.
There's another product, Ostinol.
Yes.
As well.
Right.
which is morphologic protein. Yeah.
Bone morphogenic, BMP, bone morphogenic protein.
Which would you rate that against strontium?
I would say that it is intermediate. It is probably, I haven't used it as a standalone. I use it as a supporting actor. And it's a little more expensive supplement, so it has to be used sparingly. And I would add it for more serious cases of bone loss. And, I think that it adds, maybe 10 or 20% to the overall bone enhancement properties of the other things. So you can really rev up the bone with that. Of course, BioSil, which is a bioavailable organic silica product, that's something we might use as well. And fish oil, fish oil I think plays a role, and you might want to take some anti-inflammatories. Curcumin may even play a role there. There's sort of a whole arsenal of things to use. Mm-hmm. So there you go. The DHA.
That's the blood to Lorraine.
Yeah, by the way, I prefer to test people for DHA, and there are certain circumstances where you may not want to use DHA as a man if you have a prostate problem, as a woman if you have a history of suspicious breast lesions or breast cancer. Not that it causes breast cancer, but I wouldn't want to use DHA in a woman where there's a big concern about breast cancer risk because it's hormonal.
Yeah. And just so people know, the proper DHA test is DHA sulfate. I know there's a different DHA.
Right.
Serum test, which is really not the one.
Most conventional doctors get that wrong, and so that's one of the reasons why we say, please test with us in-house, because we do the right test. And often, if you do with an outside lab, they'll do the wrong test, which is totally meaningless. It doesn't help you at all. Mm-hmm. So we have time for another question.
Okay. This comes from David. I have heard several times now that insulin resistance is caused or at least aggravated by dietary saturated fat. The concept doesn't commend itself to me, and frankly, it hasn't come from sources I would consider reliable, but I keep seeing it. So, what's your take on it? Thanks from a longtime listener from back when you took over for Dr. Atkins in the afternoons. This is from David.
Wow, that guy remembers back into the 90s, right?
Wow.
What were the popular groups then? It was like, don't stop thinking about tomorrow. It's like,
well, I'm thinking of a grunge movement.
Oh, yeah, right.
Of the Seattle scene,
Nirvana. Yeah. Nirvana,
yeah.
Yeah, right.
Nirvana, Pearl Jam, Soundgarden, Alice in Chains.
Exactly. That was that era. Okay, so that was the year in which we first started talking about that kind of stuff on the radio, and it was on in the afternoons. All right. Memory lane.
I've heard this too. May I just start by saying...
Sure, talk about the saturated fats, insulin resistance, yes.
Yeah. Here's the thing. By eating more, we have to assume by eating more dietary saturated fat, you're also eating more calories. And this is causing weight gain. And this is contributing to the insulin resistance. Does dietary saturated fat in and of itself cause insulin resistance? I would say no. But I want to remind you, as we're coming upon the Thanksgiving holiday, when you have that ginormous Thanksgiving feast, you may have some insulin resistance with that meal. Even if you're moderating your carbohydrates a little bit, there is a such thing as overindulgence with calories.
Right.
And we have to remember, even though fat, the macronutrient fat by itself, will not really raise insulin, protein does to a degree in a good way, but carbohydrates really raise it. But on top of all this, when you've snowballed all three into a whole lot of calories, it will contribute or exacerbate insulin resistance. I would agree with what David says here.
Right. So let me break it down a little bit further. I think there are studies which show that intake of saturated fat is associated with insulin resistance. The problem in those studies is it's hard to associate high levels of saturated fat in the diet from an overall poor diet, because sometimes it's a marker for a poor diet. People who consume tons of meat may not consume, such healthy food overall.
Right.
That's number one. And they haven't studied saturated fat in isolation in a low carbohydrate setting. So it may be just a marker of a diet that's not so good. The other thing is that the saturated fat that is emphasized in a high-fat American diet is not the healthiest fat. It's saturated fat that you get from animals that are fed lots of omega-6 And it's, you know, goes back to that saying, you are what you eat eats. And if you eat, it's a far cry if you eat, you know, grass-fed beef versus marbled corn-fed beef. It may have differential effects on your insulin resistance. I think it's the omega-6 fatty acids that are yes. on the feedlots that we feed to our animals that may contribute to the insulin resistance that you obtain from saturated fats. But I think by eating a lot of fish, which is rich in omega-3, and if you have grass-fed animals that are more predominantly omega-3 than omega-6, the balance is towards omega-3, that you may obviate that insulin resistance that you get from sat fats. So, yeah, you know, I think there's several caveats about that connection. And you know, look, there's no question. I mean, we see it day in and day out. You put patients on a diet low in carbs. You tell them it's okay to eat animal protein, particularly grass-fed beef, you know, poultry and fish and eggs, of course, which are fat. But, you know, we try to go with the organic eggs. That we see the insulin resistance yeah. vanish.
Yeah. There is another a case that I could think about. And this was back in the days when I worked with Dr. Atkins. We had an obese patient among many, many others. He was on a low-carb diet, but he was not losing weight. Upon further investigation, I found out for dinner he was having a 22-ounce steak.
Yeah.
Now, there's no reason for that.
Yeah.
And all that excess protein will turn to glucose in the body. You know, he stayed at his weight because he wasn't doing the diet properly. He was still overeating.
Yeah.
And that kept him, you know, where he was.
Right.
So.
So, yeah, don't put the feedback on in any case. All right. This is a logical point at which we will break because we split these podcasts into two parts. Let's stipulate this as part one. And what's coming up in part two? What can we tease for?
Part two.
Yep.
This is going to be great, Dr. Hoffman. Magnesium stearate, friend or foe?
Uh-huh. All right.
Mm.
Very good. So let's... For our listening audience, we encourage you to check out part two of today's Q&A with Layla. For additional information, I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.